from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Deep down, a lot of people around the world no doubt thought, nah, the British won't leave the European Union. But that's the way they voted, and they will. Brexit, here we come. It is hard to know how it will all unspool in the long run. Today, there is stunned amazement all over. Some in sorrow, some in joy, some in fear. UK earthquake crushes global markets, reads one headline, and the quake may go wider. We're taking it all in. This hour on Point, Britain votes to leave the European Union. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you make of it? What is the message in this vote? Where does it point the British? Where does it point the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. UK Independence Party leader Nigel Farage, thrilled with the Brexit vote. He told Leave campaigners that June 23rd should go down as the United Kingdom's Independence Day.
There are 17 million people that voted for Brexit. It's a victory for ordinary people, decent people. It's a victory against the big merchant banks, against the big businesses, and against big politics. And I'm proud of everybody that had the courage, in the face of all the threats, everything they were told, they had the guts to stand up and do the right thing.
Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron saying he will step down. He's no longer the right man to steer this ship.
I will do everything I can as Prime Minister to steady the ship over the coming weeks and months. But I do not think it would be right for me to try to be the captain that steers our country to its next destination.
Older voters said they wanted out of the EU. Younger voters said they wanted in. Here's one of those. Talked to the International Business Times at the Glastonbury Festival. She said she was disappointed in the vote to leave the European Union.
I don't agree with it at all. I think we should have stayed. I think it would have been better, like, for us as a country and that. I think it's a lot of, like, I think the younger generation think that a lot more. It's the older generation that sort of wants it out.
Joining us first today from London is Stephen Erlanger, London Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Steve Erlanger, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to be with us on this hectic day.
Hi, Tom.
Bottom line, how do you interpret what's just happened, Steve?
It has been coming. In a way, it is a rather unexpectedly successful revolution of people who feel abandoned by their politicians, who feel overwhelmed by a loss of control over immigration, who look around themselves and don't recognize the country they grew up in, who have lost jobs due to globalization or competition from very bright and well-skilled young immigrants from Central and Eastern Europe, who can come to Britain through membership of the European Union, and people who resent the elites telling them what to do. So you had a kind of populist revolt. Populism is becoming widespread. You have it some in America, too. Now we have it in Britain in big, you know, a big way.
What do you hear from, Steve, from Leave advocates today about how they feel on the morning after this, the day after this great victory? And what about Remain advocates and their fears?
Well, the Leave people are shocked that they won. In some ways, even Boris Johnson, the former mayor of London, who may end up being prime minister, I think probably felt in some ways he'd be better off, the country would be better off if they lost by just a little bit. Because it is a major change and no one knows how it's going to go. Economists, the Treasury, the central bank all say Britain's economy, which has already been weakening, will take a great hit. That the City of London and financial services, which represent 75-80% of the economy, are going to be hurt. That some companies will move out to be inside the European Union. All this is up in the air. What will happen to borders? What will happen to passports? What will happen to the people who are already here? Nobody knows. The Brexiteers don't agree among themselves. I think the Remain people, which include the entire political class except for UKIP, you quoted Mr. Farage, are stunned because the people who just put them into Parliament 13 months ago have gone against their advice and voted to leave the European Union. So there's a bit of shock and trauma. It's going to have to resolve itself, you know, over time. And the main thing to remember is that nothing's going to happen legally for quite a while. This referendum is actually legally non-binding, though the government will obey the vote. But you'll need a new prime minister. Things won't get underway probably in a serious way till September with a new government. When Britain decides to tell the EU under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty it's actually going, a two-year clock starts for negotiating an exit. And until that time, Britain is a full member of the European Union and keeps paying its dues and obeys its laws, and its citizens have the same rights as they did yesterday. So, you know, there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of movement, and the markets are shaky, which, you know, they make money from being shaky. But actually, legally, nothing has changed.
But a lot will change. I mean, when you talk about the scale of this change, 2 years and plus is not so very long. Steve Erlanger with the New York Times is with us from London. And Steve, we've got Americans really focused on this. Lots of calls and questions here. Let's take one for you from Kettering, Ohio. Eric, you're on the air with the New York Times London Bureau Chief, Stephen Erlanger.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I'm mostly concerned, you know, about the short-term effects that we've heard about Scotland possibly wanting to join the EU, and I heard earlier today Catholics and Protestants voting along religious lines, one group stay, one group go. I can't remember which, but, you know, I think about that for the UK, but what does it mean for us as well in our special relationship, kind of where are things heading with things that we thought were resolved, but maybe aren't?
Eric, let us pick that up. Of course, Scotland in the EU right now as part of Britain. But if Britain leaves, Scotland would leave unless it leaves Britain. Steve Erlinger, what about Scotland, the unity of the UK, and what about the US-UK relationship, special relationship, as the UK floats into this new definition of itself?
Well, let's deal with the second one first, because President Obama actually spoke about it today. Wherever he is, I'm not sure where he is, but he said, you know, the special relationship would continue and Britain remains a close ally of the United States, which is certainly true in military and intelligence and emotional terms. And the alliance would go on and, you know, the U.S. recognized the vote of the British and, you know, wish them well. And they're still part of NATO. And, you know, I mean, obviously Obama's putting
that's all nice. Sounds like happy talk.
Response.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's just trying to be reassuring.
Yes.
Which is okay. You know, I mean, he after all came here to Britain to urge, some would say scold, the Brits to not leave. And though they like him, they like President Obama over here, they resented him telling them what to do. And it's part of the resentment of the elites and the bosses and everyone telling them what to do, which we just saw. In terms of Scotland, the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, who runs the Scottish National Party, which dominates Scotland, said today, and she appeared before a Scottish flag and a European Union flag, that another referendum on Scottish independence was highly likely, and that Scotland felt that it had been done down democratically by English voters who wanted to leave when Scotland wanted to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's more of a threat right now because the last referendum was only, you know, a couple of years ago at the most, and they lost by 10 points, and they don't want to lose again. But rather like Quebec, if anyone remembers that, it's kind of a never-endum. And there will be one, but I don't think it'll be very soon because she will want to make sure she wins it next time rather than loses for a second time. And the economy of Scotland would have taken a hit because the price of oil is much lower now than it was during the first referendum. So I think she's bargaining politically, but she's appealing to her audience. Scotland is unhappy. It voted 62% to 38% to stay inside the European Union.
And the UK is not staying.
No. And in Northern Ireland, which your caller also referenced, Northern Ireland also voted to stay by 55 to 45. And it is true, for the most part, Roman Catholics voted to stay, and Protestants voted to leave in Northern Ireland. But, you know, this is an old story and not terribly surprising.
Mm. Steve, on this issue of the U.S., I mean, maybe the special relationship with England and Britain remains, but Britain has been America's gateway to Europe for a long time, and it's a major point in many ways of representation or leverage there. I mean, what does this say? I've just got you for a minute and a half about the West, about Europe's own cohesion.
Well, you're quite right. You're quite right, because, you know, I mean, it's not an altogether altruistic relationship. The United States, you know, has great values, you know, liberal values, economic values with Britain, and does use Britain as an advocate inside the European Union. And it does value the impact, as the Germans value the impact of British pragmatism and common sense on the European Union. And frankly, this is a big brick out of one of the major post-World War II structures of peace in Europe, together with NATO. And it is a damaging withdrawal. It's the first country to pull out of the EU. It makes the EU look broken and collapsing. It's encouraged populism everywhere, including France and Germany and in the Netherlands. There's pushes for Frexit in France and Nexit in the Netherlands. So the U.S. can see its relationship with Europe being shaken. And that's important. You're quite right.
Stephen Erlanger, London Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Steve, thank you very much for taking a moment to be with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Brexit and what it means. The sound of traders there assessing the damage during early morning trading in Britain as Brexit rocks financial markets. Around the world today, the UK will leave the European Union. We're asking what that means for Britain, Europe, the United States, the West. You can join us this hour. Were you stunned at the news this morning that England, all of Britain, will go? And what is the lesson here? That political establishments can lose touch with the people? That nationalist demagogues can turn us backwards? Is Bernie Sanders right that this is a sign that the global economy is not working for ordinary people? And I guess this is the West breaking up. I don't know if it's breaking up or breaking down. Boris Johnson, former London mayor, Leave campaigner, big advocate of the Leave movement that has now won, said today the British can be optimistic about a future without the laws and protocols of the European Union.
It is the essence of our case that young people in this country can look forward to a more secure and more prosperous future if we take back the democratic control that is the foundation of our economic prosperity.
Boris Johnson, flamboyant former mayor of London, he of the big hair, celebrating the Leave vote today. Here's Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, was in favor of remaining, a little tepidly, some says, nevertheless, favored remain in the EU, said today it's important to respect that the British people have spoken.
I think a lot of the message that's come back from this is that many communities are fed up with cuts they've had, fed up with economic dislocation, and feel very angry at the way they've been betrayed and marginalized by successive governments.
Headline over much of the world, earthquake. With us right now from London, the editor of the Financial Times, Lionel Barber. Lionel Barber was with us the day before the vote. No one knew how it would go. Now we know. Lionel Barber, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be here. I'm so glad I didn't predict the result on your program.
Yes. And how quickly things go and turn. How do you interpret? What is it, sort of 52-48% for the victors, the Leave movement here? How do you interpret what's happened, Lionel?
This is a vote, a huge, massive, heartfelt vote against the establishment, against elites. It's a vote which echoes the strain of populism which you're seeing in the United States, not just through Donald Trump, but Bernie Sanders. You're seeing it in France. You're seeing it in Rome earlier this week in their elections. You're also seeing a country which is genuinely divided between young and old, between towns and countryside, between big cities, metropolitan, open, London, Manchester, and the countryside. And all this has been laid bare. And, too, The division between North and South, it's very important today to note that the Scots mm-hmm. and their leadership have announced that they are looking at another referendum on independence. So a profound shock to the United Kingdom. We have a constitutional crisis in effect because the Prime Minister said he's resigning. We don't know who the next Prime Minister will be. And as I warned earlier this week, the Leave campaign have no program for what kind of relationship they want to have with the European Union.
I want to look at that. You mentioned Bernie Sanders. He's been talking about this. Of course, Donald Trump has too. Here was Sanders on CBS this morning saying it illustrates this Brexit vote, pro-Brexit, that many people feel left behind in the global economy.
The establishment sometimes forgets that real live flesh and blood people in this country are hurting, and they're hurting badly. You're the average male worker in this country. You know what? You're earning less in real dollars today than you did 40 years ago, and you're worried to death about the future of your children.
Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times. Could the same be said by a British politician today or in these last weeks? Has it been said? And if elites have been out of touch with their constituents, with their fellow countrymen, how did they float so far away? How did they miss this?
It does speak to this sense that there are a segment of the population, less well-educated, not earning a lot of money, squeezed down in the lower segment of the labour market, and fearful of immigration. These people all voted for Brexit. But it is really important to note that there were other people in the shires, the people near the golf courses, the people with plenty of money, older generation, protected pensions. These people voted also to leave Europe out of a sense of anti-Brussels, we want our country back. We want to be independent. We want to go back to Great Britain. They were seduced, I would argue, by some very effective campaigning. So it wasn't just the marginalized people in Britain.
A pitchfork moment, the Financial Times calls it today. Donald Trump very much picking up, he was in Scotland at one of his golf courses, picking up on that take our country back theme, which he's used very much in the U.S. as well. Here was Trump in Scotland.
People want to take their country back. They want to have independence in a sense. And you see it with Europe, all over Europe. You're going to have more than just, in my opinion, more than just what happened last night.
Lionel Barber, can Britain, post this vote, have it both ways? Can it take control back and have access to the European market and all the advantages that the EU has afforded its citizens of free movement and all the rest? What's the future look like on that front?
It is very murky. There's an awful lot of fog over the channel between England, Great Britain, and the continent. I think it's going to be very hard for a new British government led by Prime Minister, we don't know, it could be Boris Johnson, the Pied Piper of London. We don't know what the exact relationship that he or others want between Britain and the continent. They say they don't want freedom of movement because that spells more immigration. But if you say you don't want freedom of movement, you are saying, too, that you don't want guaranteed access to the single market.
Yeah.
That's a market where the financial services industry, the City of London, the airline industry, cheap fares, all these people, telecoms, cheaper roaming charge, all these things depend on the single market.
And if it's closed, it's not a single market. David in Omaha, Nebraska, you're on with Lionel Barber in London.
Thanks, Tom. First-time caller, long-time listener. Mm-hmm. My question, just concisely, briefly, is in three parts for Lionel Barber. Your previous guest, Mr. Erlanger, suggested that the result of the vote could have been a surprise even for Mr. Johnson and the Leave camp. If that's the case, how much of Mr. Johnson's efforts as an advocate on the issue for the Leave camp can be considered, or might be considered, a certain amount of cynical attempt to gain political favor.
Okay.
Number one. Number two, could there be a backlash on the part of working class voters against Mr. Johnson? And finally, if he is billed and going to be the next Tory leader and the presumptive prime minister, as many have suggested, how can that be if he's not even
How can that be if he's not even a member of Parliament?
Well, he's a member of Parliament.
Yeah, there's that.
It's we don't know whether Boris Johnson will be the next Prime Minister. What we do know is that he'd like to be the next Prime Minister. No question about that. Was he surprised? There are some people who do believe that the Leave camp never were quite convinced that they could do it. But they made a very effective campaign, and now, it has to be said, they have the responsibility for working out what's going to happen next. Interestingly, they said in the early hours of the morning or late at night that they wanted David Cameron to stay on as Prime Minister, presumably because they wanted him to go to Brussels and take the responsibility for negotiating a new deal. Well, he's made very clear he's not going to do that, so it's up to them.
That's their job to do. Introduce Boris Johnson to us a bit, if you would. Many Americans have seen his photograph over the year, the big shock of hair on the former London mayor, but Americans are paying attention to the UK today in a way I can't recall in many years. Introduce us to Boris Johnson.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I had the fortune, or occasionally the misfortune, to work alongside Boris Johnson when he was the correspondent in Brussels for the Daily Telegraph.
Former journalist.
I was the chief correspondent for the Financial Times.
Mm-hmm.
And Boris Johnson had an appalling French accent. He was an eccentric. And he, I have to say, made up, or at least embellished his stories. His stories were always characterized by a heavy anti-Brussels bias, and nobody took him that seriously. Now he's shown very strong ambition. He did a decent job as mayor of London, and I think quite a few journalists would be surprised that back in those days, in 1992, that this man is now within a few inches of the top job.
You spent time in the States. You're right there. Can you picture a year from now we'd be talking about perhaps a President Donald Trump and a Prime Minister Boris Johnson sort of negotiating the fate of much?
Well, there would be it would be great theater, but there comes a point where the comedy has to stop, and where people have to take responsible decisions. Mr. Trump at least has a business record of sorts. Mr. Johnson has no such record, but he is a great wordsmith. He's a great man. He sees himself, by the way, he wrote a biography of Churchill, and he definitely sees some comparisons with himself as a writer, historian, classicist. Interestingly, by the way, his younger brother, who also worked at the Financial Times, mm-hmm. is completely opposed to his point of view, is the Science and Universities Minister, who warned constantly throughout the campaign that British universities and colleges of higher education would suffer as a result of us leaving.
You say, the Financial Times writes today, that Britain's role in the world will be weakened. How?
Because we, no question, are stronger as part of a grouping in Europe where we are one strong voice alongside France and Germany. I seriously worry that this decision by the British people will lead us to becoming a marginal player. We'll be on the fringes. We'll be a sort of greater Norway. And that worries me, because the British people and the British nation, the United Kingdom, has always been open, always engaged. And I don't think that this decision will help that status in any way.
You say it will be a devastating blow to the EU. Describe what the Financial Times foresees.
We have to worry about the contagion effect of this referendum result. Maybe other countries, we've already seen this in the Netherlands, there have been some calls perhaps for having their own referendum. We have a presidential election in France next year where the populist, hard right populist Marine Le Pen is riding high in the polls. We may see other Nordic nations decide they want to hold a referendum or move apart. The European Union is in a very fragile state. It's still grappling with a slow growth in the Eurozone and the most serious migration crisis since 1945. So this comes at the worst possible moment. And if Britain, who we thought was a stable, conservative country, decides to ignore all the expert opinion, all the institutions, Barack Obama, the OECD, the IMF, and we all say nonsense to economics, we're going our own way, what kind of signal does that send to the rest of Europe?
Lionel Barber is editor of the Financial Times. He's joined us from London in England. Lionel Barber, thank you very much for being with us again. Good luck.
We'll need it.
On the continent, today in Brussels, Jean-Claude Juncker, president of the European Commission, said Europe was facing an unprecedented situation, but would remain strong with its remaining members.
We will stand strong and uphold the European Union's core values of promoting peace and the well-being of its peoples. The union of 27 member states will continue.
We want to look at how this looks from the other side of the English Channel. Josef Jaffe joins us right now from Hamburg, Germany, editor of the German newspaper Die Zeit. Josef Jaffe, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi there.
Yes.
For having me.
Yeah. And from London, Francesco Guerrera joins us, associate editor, chief financial correspondent for Politico Europe. Francesco, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Josef Jaffe, in Hamburg, what does this mean to Germany, to the EU?
Well, the first thing to note is that the Merkel government has been uncharacteristically quiet. They still have to figure out how to deal with this. Well, this is a historical watershed. So now it's the usual round of talks between the parties and then with heads of with the French and the Italian head of state and prime minister will begin. They are just as flabbergasted as everybody else who, I have to admit, including myself, went to bed last night thinking this will be a pretty strong vote against Brexit. We was wrong.
Can the European Union survive the loss of Britain?
Of course, no. But of course
it not.
Survive. No, of course it will survive. There will be 26. But it will not survive very well. I mean, look what it's about to lose. Almost one-fifth of its GDP.
Yeah.
The most vibrant economy and a low-growth economy on the continent. You know, a voice for free markets and free trade against the kind of dirigisme of what I call Club Med, you know, Italy, mm-hmm. France, Spain, etc. They will also, Europe will also lose a power that is still willing and able to use force against the malfeasance du jour. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they will lose the financial center of the city, which has been around for 400 years. The list is endless. But, of course, it will survive. Unless what I don't think, but that's what's being bandied about, is now that the little Britons in Europe, like Poland, Hungary, Denmark, will feel encouraged and also go for their version of Brexit. I don't think so. They will be more rational, not in terms of European virtue, but in terms of their own best interests.
Francesco Guerrera in London, forgive me, Mr. Jaffe, but I've just a minute before the break, and I want to get Francesco. Does the European economy work with Britain headed into this? Not really in, but not really wanting to be entirely out status, but definitely not in the EU.
Well, it does depend a lot on how the negotiations turn out and what exactly the relationship between the two blocs is, right? Mm-hmm. Those two blocs trade a lot with each other. Now, admittedly, Britain gets more out of it than Europe itself, but Europe does need Britain especially for financial services. Now, you cannot have an economy the size of Europe not relying on financial services, nor can you have the financial services center for Europe based outside Europe, as you have now in this situation, which is now surreal. I'm based in London. I talk to a lot of the City of London guys, and they really don't know what's going to happen. Do they have to move to Frankfurt? Do they have to move to Dublin? Do they have to move to Paris? Can they stay here? This decision, which was unexpected, was really plunged the financial services sector, the markets, and the economy into unprecedented uncertainty.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the Brexit and what it means. The UK will leave the EU. We're asking what that means for Britain, Europe, the US, the West. What do you see here? If Britain is not really tied to Europe, is the US really tied to Europe? Is the West breaking up? Is Donald Trump more in tune with the British majority here? And what if it's one day Prime Minister Boris Johnson and President Donald Trump, where do we go? Josef Jaffe is with us. He's editor of the German newspaper Die Zeit, joins us today from Hamburg, Germany. Francesco Guerrera is with us, associate editor, chief financial correspondent for Politico Europe. Here was Jenny Watson, the chief counting officer responsible for announcing the final tally of the Brexit vote. We've heard this and just can't get enough of it. This is the number that made it happen.
The total number of votes cast in favor of leave was 17,410,742. This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Yeah! Across the channel, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, low-key, but she did speak about Britain's decision to leave the European Union. She urged European leaders to remain calm, interpreted here by the BBC.
We, the remaining 27 member states of the European Union, show our willingness and ability in this situation not to be too hasty and come to hasty decisions out of Britain's exit decision, which would further intensify rifts in Europe. Instead, we have to remain calm and composed.
We've got callers for you, Josef Jaffe and Francesco Guerrera Nichols in Eastport, Maine. Nichols, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I lived in England both before they joined the EU and during the EU, and I think I understand what's happened. I think there's really a basic fear here of modernism, of contemporary life, but I think also that the people just simply don't see the country that they knew and loved, which is why it's the older people who voted against it.
Are you sympathetic with that, Nichols, or not?
Yes, I'm sympathetic to it in the sense that I understand it. I worry about what's going to happen. I really am terribly worried because I think none of us know. It's just an absolute unknown. But I think they look around and they just don't recognize what they see. And that's brought about this fear that's resorted to going back.
Nichols, I appreciate your call. Josef Jaffe in Hamburg, Germany. The British might not be the only ones feeling that way. I mean, there's been pushback in Germany after the very large influx of refugees that came last year. We see today in France, Marine Le Pen saying the French now must also have the right to choose. The Dutch, you know, the Geert Wilders there saying they need a Nexit vote. Now it's our turn. He wants to vote on European membership as well. Can you see this Brexit, I don't know, contagion, if that's the way you look at it, spreading on the continent?
Well, first of all, the Germans do not hanker for a long-lost past because their past has been pretty horrifying. So they're pretty safe. The other countries, look, it depends on whether you can easily start a referendum or not. The Dutch are an interesting example. You know, in 2005, they voted against the so-called European Constitution, but then we had a second referendum, and they voted for. Same for Ireland, same for Denmark and others. So I'm not that worried about the Europeans, especially since in this multi-party system, the populist right, call them that way, between Stockholm and Lisbon, can capture the votes of 10-15% at the worst, in France of 30%, but it's very hard for them to capture a majority the way they have captured the Republican Party under Trump. That won't work in the proportional representation system of Europe. But of course, there will be rumbling, there will be contagion, I trust, but you know, I've been wrong in the Brexit. That it will be contained, especially since if our, you know, establishment, our elites, whatever you call them, heed this as a wake-up call to stop plowing ahead on European integration, which has removed the seat of power ever farther from the democratic electorate.
What about the economy? Francesco says it just doesn't work without the City of London, i.e. the financial center there. Germany is the powerhouse, the main economic engine of the EU. How do you see an economy with Britain outside the EU?
As I said, Britain is the most dynamic economy. It's the only large country that's actually growing. But, you know, I invoke Karl Marx, who famously said, capital knows no fatherland. So I'm least worried about the financial industry. They will find ways to reestablish themselves in mm-hmm. Frankfurt, in New York, mm-hmm. perhaps even London. That is not the problem. But I don't think another thing that is not a problem is I don't think that Britain's leaving on strictly growth terms will make that much of a difference. Britain has been around, growing rapidly, and yet that kind of contagion, in quotation marks, has not infected the continentals, who keep kind of floating along again between 0 and 1% growth. That is the least of my problems.
Wow. Zach in Heartland, Vermont. Zach, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you could comment on the rise of populist and just extreme right-wing groups across Europe in general, in Greece, as well as referendums in Catalonia and Spain to separate. Just those types of trends in Europe, but also internationally in our own country. And I wonder if it's too much to think that there could also be some interference from Russia, for example, that this that Europe itself as a united economic body stands in the path of its own growth or its own agenda.
We will. Thank you, Zach. Francesco Guerrera, what about it? In the UK, I mean, this is being, we heard from Steve Erlanger with The Times, from Lionel Barber with The Financial Times. This is a rejection of the elites.
Yeah.
Zach,
Francesco
asked about populism on the continent, but speak to the UK first and how this was sold.
Yes, well, I think Zach is right. There is that rise of right-wing extremists across the continent. But I think in the UK, it was more than that, because if it only been that, it would have been a fringe, right? Mm-hmm. We just heard that 17 million people voted to sever their ties with the European Union. Now, yep. 17 million people are not all extremists. Mm-hmm. There is something more at play here, which is what the rejection of the elites, but there's also a historical problem that Britain has, which they never resolved, and it plays itself out in the older generation, which is they never, and I'm simplifying, is they never gotten over the end of the empire. They don't know what to do with themselves after the end of the empire, and they don't accept this submission of sovereignty into a bigger whole, which is the European Union. And so this is not something that you see replicated outside Britain. It's a British issue which came to the fore in the referendum, added to all the other issues that we discussed, created this enormous mass of people who wanted to leave. So there's a British, if you like, individuality, a British specificity to what just happened here.
Josef Yaffe, what about the complaint? You say that the seat of power moved too far away from the democratic electorate. Is there a structural problem here? If there is, how does the EU overcome it so that others don't feel, well, it's just unelected bosses up there telling us what to do?
You just asked the $64 question. The EU, I would call the EU a kind of post-democratic institution, where we were quite happy to leave tough issues to unelected representatives, like all governments left monetary policy to Mario Draghi of the European Central Bank, mm-hmm. happy that he broke all the laws and flooded Europe with cheap money. Now, I don't know. The way we constructed the European Union was along a technocratic expert model. We outsourced government. Give you just a telling number. About 50 to 60% of legislation coming before European national parliaments have been formulated, promulgated in Brussels by unelected representatives like the Commission or the European Council, which represents governments, but it's still one large step removed from the electorate. How? I don't think you can turn the EU into something really democratic, because democracy requires a demos, which is Greek for a people, for a nation that shares values, that speaks the same language. That assembles in the public space to debate policy. I don't see how you can do that unless we decide, the undemocratic EU decides, as of now, we'll all speak English.
I mean, the American example, we have liked to think, suggest that you don't have to share blood. You don't have to share exactly the same values or the same fundamental values, and maybe not even the same language, and yet you can have a demos, a working democracy.
But look, the way those 13 colonies got together was, first of all, they were all British subjects. They had imported from Britain the British model of governance and values, call it the Enlightenment or liberalism. Mm-hmm. They spoke the same language from Virginia to Massachusetts, and they were fused together by the Revolution. By the way, there was almost a civil war during the Revolution, fused together by a common enemy. And they did not look back at 2,000 years of separate national development. I don't think that the American model has much relevance to the European case. Mm.
Kathleen in Dayton, Ohio. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Hey, I've spent the last 8 years in Dayton, Ohio, where I grew up. I'm taking care of my senior parents. And I meet all these guys who are like my father, World War II vet, Teamster. But I talk to these guys who were GM, former GM workers, and now they're working at Walmart. You know, they had been making 25 bucks an hour, now they're making 10.
Yep.
So if you draw a parallel between the dissatisfaction here in the U.S. in regard to the elite, what would be the equivalent in the U.K.? Have jobs left there over the last four decades? What's the minimum wage like? And then on regard to the influx of refugees, is the population upset about the U.S. and the U.K.'s roles in, you know, kind of creating more ungoverned territory for groups like ISIS in Iraq, Libya, and Syria?
Kathleen, I'll pick up the first part for sure. I mean, we should say in the EU, the U.K., the main thing has been not refugees, but workers who've come in from the rest of the EU, including Eastern Europe. We'll look at all of it. Francisco Guerrero, what about the U.S. parallel, the U.K. parallel to the going from GM to Walmart and seeing jobs exported? Kathleen asks if that's been the experience of Britons who may have voted against the EU.
There is definitely a parallel. It's not quite the same as the U.S. There's definitely a parallel, what, you know, people like Larry Summers called the soft middle. There is a portion of the middle class, in the lower middle class in the U.K., which has had the same experience as the U.S. middle class. I think the other point is perhaps more powerful in this case, which is the fear of their jobs being stolen by immigrants coming from Europe, though, not from Syria, but coming from Europe, coming into the United Kingdom without any filters, right? That is the biggest fear. Now, it's got to be said, it was a fear. It wasn't really a reality in terms of numbers. And it's also true that the U.K. economy has been growing faster than many European economies. So there is enough slack in the labor market here to accommodate those refugees. Nevertheless, that was the winning argument for the Leave campaign, which took hold not just among the soft middle that we discussed, so white male of working age, but also among the older generations, mixed with the thing I was talking about before, which is the harking back to the empire.
Yosef Yaffe, if the U.K. anchored the United States to Europe in some sense, culturally and maybe more, without the U.K. being so tightly tied to the EU, is there a chance now that Europe drifts into some kind of middle zone further from the United States and maybe even toward Russia?
Well, first of all, I think the champagne corks must be popping in the Kremlin, because Mr. Putin can now look forward to a Europe that is certainly strategically weakened without Britain in the fold. Will it drift culturally? No way. I mean, Europe is so safely, quote-unquote, Americanized in its culture, from, you know, movies to baseball caps, that it's hands down for the United States and Russia or even China have nothing to offer in terms of that kind of imitation effect on magnetism. Will, as far as drifting off politically, the game is now in the hands of Angela Merkel, the chancellor of the centrally located and power and the largest nation. She has been actually quite hard on Putin, and she will, as long as she rules, hold that line. And let me tell you, next year when everybody goes to the polls, so do the Germans, and I predict confidently, but you won't ask me next year, that Merkel will get another 4-year terms. So not that much to worry on the political diplomatic front.
Josef, I think those bells are ringing behind you in Hamburg. What do you think? Yes. What are they telling us, Josef, besides the time?
They're telling us that in Hamburg it's now 5 to 6 or 5 to 12 where you are. I'm so sorry. There's nothing I can do about it.
No, that's all right. It's just great.
I don't have the power.
No, it's quite all right. We don't know who does have the power these days. Francesco, Josef says, look, the financial industry will move wherever it needs to go to keep Europe lubricated with money. What about the rest of the economy? Does this work?
It's going to be a massive experiment. We never seen anything like this before. Now, of course, you know, market theory will tell you, well, they'll move where, you know, the jobs are, the money is. But to extract such a big industry, the financial services industry in this case, from the UK and place it elsewhere would be a massive undertaking and a displacement of people, or you have to find new people. I mean, the financial industry in the UK employs something like 400,000 people, so you have to move all 400,000 people somewhere else. The rest of the economy will largely depend on what kind of deal the UK strikes with Europe in terms of trade. If they can trade, then the UK will be fine. If they cannot trade or they have barriers, then the UK will be in trouble.
We will follow it all. Epic day, kind of earthquake day. Francesco Guerrera, Chief Financial Correspondent for Politico Europe. Thank you very much for joining us, Francesco.
Thank you.
And Josef Jaffe, editor of the German newspaper Die Zeit. Thank you, Herr Jaffe.
It was a pleasure, as always.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.